Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Velkommen til Liberal halvtime. Mitt navn Lars Peder Nordbakken, og sammen med meg har jeg kollega Guy Kiddy, som ved siden av å skrive om Norden og Baltikum for The Economist, også bidrar med samfunnspolitisk analyse i Civita. Dette den andre episoden av i alt tre episoder, hvor Guy og jeg samtaler om en ny liberal samfunnskontrakt for fremtiden. Selv om jeg også kan rapportere at det stadig fremganger i Guys norsk varigheter, så vil det også denne samtalen foregå på engelsk. Guy, welcome again to this second conversation about this exciting subject of the new social contract.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here again.
Thank you. Good. From the last episode, we did try to explore this concept of social contract, what it is, and but in more general terms, I think. And we agreed that we need to make this concept more specific and concrete in order to make sense of it, really.
Absolutely. I think we've gone through the sort of philosophical basis of what the social contract can mean from a historical perspective, and now it's time to put some meat on the bone, so to speak.
Absolutely. So that's, I think, more or less exactly what we're going to do today in this episode. And I think we also agree that you and I, we are basically liberals, and when we speak about the subject of social contract, we are, in a broad sense, maybe aiming towards a concept of liberal progress at the same time in terms of expanding freedom and opportunities and life options for everyone, and in particular subject to a common flaw, a basic security for everyone, this basic fairness principle. If everyone is secured a basic minimum, well, there is less objection for anyone climbing as high as one can, maybe on the ladder, if you will. Should we try to get into the specifics? And maybe we talked about last time also, got some inspiration from a few names.
We did indeed. Yeah.
One of them was William Beveridge.
William Beveridge, yeah, the great British liberal who was really the main brain behind the British welfare state, which came into being after the Second World War and was an inspiration in many other places besides, including Norway. And at the very heart of his approach to formulating the welfare state in the UK and inspiring that process elsewhere was what he called the five evils. Want, so having the resources that you need, financial resources, to be able to pay your way in life. Squalor, so freedom from the very poor living conditions, but in particular that characterised pre-war Britain, full of tuberculosis, very poor quality housing, that kind of thing. Disease, which comes from squalid surroundings. Ignorance, so lack of education and opportunity. And perhaps in of all of these, the least concrete, idleness. In other words, he thought people shouldn't be hanging around and doing nothing with their lives. And in fact, most people aren't happy with doing that, of course. But without those other four things in place, then idleness is possibly more inevitable than it would otherwise be. So that was then. And if we think about now, clearly times have changed quite a bit. Not very many people in the developed world live in squalid conditions, for example. A lot of people, most people, have a decent roof over their head. We have free universal education, at least up to the age of 18, in most developed countries. So there's a level of education that is unprecedented if you look over the course of human history. But still, these points are a good basis to consider the kind of society and that basis that you were talking about in the introduction there, of a kind of minimum standard for everyone, which is a springboard then for realizing one's full potential. Mm. So perhaps in this episode we can look at some of the priorities for today and what those might be, and some of the key problems, the key issues that we're facing as a society, not just in Norway but a global society, and then perhaps some of the solutions we might suggest for addressing in a very broad way those key problems. So we're living in a global world, a globalized and heavily digitalized world, and it's becoming even more digitalized. So Maybe we can start there with some thoughts. What do you reckon?
Yeah, we might do that. Of course, we cannot escape being part of a very integrated world economy, and And let us. We are going to talk a lot about work later on. So I think this about talking about globalization and digitalization, which are some of the great transforming forces happening all around the world these days, is also an overture in a way to what we're coming back to later on. What I find fascinating, or inescapable, at least, the pattern of globalization is more or less broadly the same as the pattern of division of labor internationally. And it is constantly changing. And we can talk about the speed of change, seems to be speeding up over the times. And thinking about this, the pattern of and then again, I think the real pattern of globalization is actually formed by the interplay of these three big changing forces. One is politics, and the other is technology, and the third is market or market processes, and how these work together. And and if we don't need to talk too much about what happened in the 1980s and 1990s and 2000s, because we had this big globalization expansion from many, many reasons. But what is happening now? And what strikes me is really that what we have been experiencing during this pandemic, we have been experiencing some interesting things. We do a lot of meetings online on Zoom and Teams. And so this is expressing something very interesting that I read about before the pandemic by Richard Baldwin, who wrote this book, The Globotics Upheaval. And he says that this is the new big change that is really going to impact the pattern of division of labor, in the sense that the costs of face-to-face contact and interaction and exchange of ideas
is going to increase.
Has been drastically reduced. Mm. And if you can do remote surgery, which is done these days, and you can do remote meetings, well, you can do a lot of other things remote, I think. Mm. I think maybe we are in the beginning of a revolution here, which would not impact so much the manufacturing jobs as it did in the 1980s and 90s, and talk about the Rust Belt in the US, but now perhaps more into the service, the routinized service activities can be placed in several parts of the world. So that may be a disrupting force that may come up. And
it's very interesting.
Just the big challenge there that Baldwin posed, and indirectly now to us, is to see that what should we think about in terms of this possible and probably ongoing transformative process. And that is perhaps the tricky thing, is that there may be a competition in the speed of job destruction on the one hand, and job creation on the other. And it's always going down to what happens in the local communities as well. So that is the big challenge. It goes directly into the future work in a way as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
How do you think about it?
But I just wanted to pick up on one thing. You'll notice when you mentioned that the cost of interaction is decreasing. My assumption immediately was that you were going to say it's increasing, because I was, of course, assuming in-person interaction. But of course, you're talking about remote interaction. Maybe just also a thought on the fact that globalization, in a strange way, is becoming local again. It's becoming a local phenomenon, because we can do all of these things remotely. And there is a parallel to this. You talked about manufacturing perhaps not being so affected, but what about repatriation of manufacturing with these digital technologies now, which make things like micro-manufacturing, additive manufacturing, small-scale manufacturing for highly specific things much more possible than they ever have been before? You know, these are products that are typically made in the Far East at the moment. They're shipped in containers. We're nearing a point now where, here in Norway, for example, very, very high value manufacturing, export-led manufacturing, but that supply chain can shrink because of those new manufacturing technologies. So clearly that's an impact, a big impact for globalization.
Absolutely. And well, of course, if you take the robotics that is part of the new manufacturing scene. That is actually what is driving what you mentioned now in many ways. So where wage costs used to be a good reason to place a production site at the low-wage country, now that competitive advantage for that country is much more, it's reduced drastically if you can do, if robots can do that closer to home or closer to the market, actually. So this is just another way of saying, of course, that there are several forces that are really behind a constantly shifting pattern of change, which certainly impact us all, and sometimes abruptly. And from a social point of view, that is probably the tricky thing. That if the speed of change is getting higher, at the same time as the consequences of these disruptive, changing ways of doing things along the value chain, stretching it out or shortening it in or replacing it geographically or whatever, then there is the speed of creative destruction in the economy, I think, must be increasing in some way.
Yeah.
So the challenge of security, income security, work security, how to do it and so on is really becoming a big issue in the future.
Yeah. And this is a discussion that was sparked by a seminal paper by Carl Benedict Frye in 2013 on the future of work, which didn't give a time frame, but did say that a significant proportion, maybe half of jobs currently done by people around the world would be vulnerable to being taken over by computers and robots. And even now in the professions, we're talking in medicine, in a former life, I worked a lot with medical technology and with radiologists specifically. And while they are in no danger of losing their jobs, their jobs have changed mainly from being clinicians to being data scientists, because a lot of the monitoring and a lot of the analysis is done by computers. So at the very top of a highly, highly skilled profession like that, there's this massive change going on the way. And if you go down the rungs a bit, look at the law, pre-formulated contracts, automated contracts, accounting, professional services, all of these things. Many of those processes can be automated. We've long known, though, that in blue-collar jobs, in factories, and for people with lower levels of education, automation, robotization have made working life much more unstable. And that's been the case since the late 80s, early 90s. We saw it very dramatically in America, of course, with the shrinkage and the rationalization of the automotive industry there. Seen it in my own United Kingdom, with a lot of heavy industry and manufacturing being wound down and taken overseas. And clearly this has major implications for communities. It has major implications for social mobility and for politics. A lot of the populism that we've seen, certainly in the first decades of this century, can be attributed to that increasingly unstable working life that many people face. And indeed for people in my generation, I'm a millennial, I'm 33. And I can tell you that the vast majority of my friends, left university, very good universities, and have for the last 10 years been working mainly on short-term contracts. The so-called gig economy, right? It's not gig economy in terms of delivering food on scooters. You know, it's professional work, but it's still, 6 months at a time. And how can you plan financially when you're living in those circumstances? You can't buy a house. Obviously, you can't borrow money when you have such an insecure and uncertain income. So that's one side of things. How do you deal with that, the rapidity of that change and that instability? Well, you need to equip people with the skills repeatedly through their lives to adapt to a changing economy. So the whole approach to education needs to change. The mindset there at the moment is still very much that education happens predominantly when you're a young person. You go through compulsory schooling, maybe you go to university or you do an apprenticeship, and then you go into the world of work. And that model has worked fairly well until now. But we're all aware that probably most people are going to have two or three completely different careers in their working life or more now. So clearly the state mechanisms need to be in place to fund that and enable that provision. But there's also a flip side to that, which is if people are going to be taking time out of working life to retrain and to explore new professional routes, then how are they going to make ends meet? Where's that income going to come in the meantime? Come from in the meantime? Is it going to be some sort of subsidy, or are there other mechanisms that we can explore? And I think that's possibly the next point we're going to discuss. But before we go to that, that point, what are your thoughts on that broad sweep of? It's kind of doom, isn't it? I don't mean to sound so negative about things.
I tried to think about something positive in Baldwin's book as well. Yeah. There is maybe also a silver lining somewhere, and to the extent there is, maybe that as many working operations are taken over by artificial intelligence and robotics and new ways of division of labor. There is something that what is left for us humans to do is perhaps even more humanized in a way, that the things we are best at doing, responding to novel situations, creativity, taking care of people, all the social interactions that are necessary. Well, there are so many things that we can be comparatively even more better at those kind of things. That's civil learning. But I think we have to go back to your basic problem, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, my first thought about when you started to think about education cannot be something in the future that you only do when you're young and then you have a long career, a mono career, because we are probably going to have multi-careers, I mean, changing jobs, needing to retool, needing to retrain. And so education is a never-ending kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Lifelong learning concept is central. Of course, you have the Danish are the perhaps the most extreme in the world, in terms of this flexicurity concept.
And in terms of the amount of money that the state provides, invests in that flexicurity model.
That was what I was thinking about. I mean, is it extraordinary for a country to use 2% of GDP for active labor market policies, mm-hmm. which they actually do? It's the highest tax country, one of the highest tax countries in the world, but it has a labor market flexibility with a very high and generous level of support and income support and security. But even more, I mean, conditionalizing that with, you know, it's a condition that you are actively involved in searching for new work, even able or willing to change place of living. But if you do that, if you comply with those kind of rules of the game, you are supported in a very efficient manner. So that is a way to, it's a model, a broad model, not a perfect model, I think, but mm-hmm. it has to be adapted to every country. But it's a way out. I mean, to do more of that in your direction, actually.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. I mean, as you say, 2% of GDP, making that fiscally sustainable in a country where there's no tradition of it in the first place. I mean, the Danes have a lot of experience of this. Where is that kind of investment going to come from in a country like the UK, for example, which has no tradition of this at all? I mean, if you lose your job in the UK, then you're lucky if you, you'll get some sort of income support, which is very, very low, about £100 a week, perhaps. And then you're lucky if you get maybe an hour or two of help to try and find some replacement job from the state.
A very good point, though.
Yeah.
The question you asked. How is this going to be sustainable?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And, well, I think the Danes would say that the way it is sustainable is because it's also impacting productivity growth. So, through this indirect route, you have more flexibility in the labor market and also thus in the market economy as such, which makes it easier to channel resources into more productive uses and reduce the use of resources in less productive applications. So that dynamism has probably been supported by this.
Mm.
And that's the beauty of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the globalized world, and this is a little, we are a little country, we are very similar to Denmark, Sweden also, but we are using a little less, but we're still also using a lot of resources into active labor market policies.
Mm-hmm.
And those are probably one of the things we have to build further on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, that is a very inspiring model and one that clearly works very well in Denmark. I have thought long and hard more broadly about the question of income and income security. And one thing that appeals to me greatly is the idea of basic income. And you notice I don't say universal basic income because that implies that everybody gets some kind of subsidy from the state. And of course, there are lots of people who don't need that. Another way of looking at this is in terms of what you might call negative income tax. In other words, if you earn below a certain threshold, then actually you get tax credits from the state. But whatever you call it, a minimum payment and a minimum income, therefore, guaranteed for everyone, that will guarantee a minimum standard of living to cover housing costs, education, utilities, food, all the essentials. That could work in tandem with that kind of flexicurity policy. As part of that Danish model, I know that there are generous support mechanisms for people who are between work. But that, is really an essential foundation if we're looking at a population of people who are going to be doing periods of work in one profession and one area and then having to take time out and live potentially without earned income for periods of time. I think there are other, you were talking about productivity before and how this Danish model does boost productivity. I think that's another potential great benefit of a basic income, because people will be more willing to move on from professions and areas of work that they either don't enjoy or where it's clear to them that there isn't much of a future. Also, employers would be more empowered to rationalize staff numbers. I think unions would be more willing to support that kind of rapid shift in a country like Norway, where you have the tripartite system. And of course, unions are very much in favor of protecting workers' rights and standing up for workers. I think obviously there's going to have to be a mindset shift there as well. And if they could see that actually, yes, it might be quite disruptive for people to be made redundant more frequently, but with that support mechanism in place, those people would not be left out on a limb, right? They would be able to make ends meet until they were able to find work elsewhere. So that's one thing. And then we talk of this,
it's one thing before we get too far past the point. Mm-hmm. There's one thing I would like to raise about labor unions.
Mm-hmm.
Labor unions have been traditionally one part of this very creating this kind of security, but really coming from a world of quite, the basic model is lifelong careers, so very stable mm-hmm. employment conditions, and the kind of policies that you recommend, guys, are leaning more towards or are more dependent upon what the state, what the government is contributing to citizens as such.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a feeling that if you look at the question of will labor unions be more or less important for the individual?
Probably less so.
in this transition, yeah.
Mm.
And you say less.
Probably less so in that sphere of activity. But if we take a step back and look at education, then actually I think that education is something that could be a really major part of the bargaining process under that tripartite system. Not only because it's such an essential part of working life now, an ongoing working life, but there are other factors besides. And I think we'll probably talk about this a bit later on. But you see a problem throughout the world in corporations, particularly with what we call the financialization of profits. In other words, turning profits into financial instruments, and that money not being reinvested either into the company or research and development or into the state. Right? It goes into shareholders' pockets eventually. It turns into capital. with that education provision being part of the of the bargaining process, then that is a surefire way of saying to companies, actually, you know, there is a certain minimum that we expect here, and clearly there's a productivity boost that comes out of that in the long run.
I find this very interesting topic. It's something that isn't discussed a lot, but as I think Martin Wolf and others have been writing about, the way companies are run is of great importance to how an economy performs in a country. Ultimately, of course, it's conditioned by the rules of the game, mm-hmm. The policies that are framing how the market and company law and a lot of things, but of course the importance of what you're saying, I think, is shouldn't be minimized, because the financialization of profits through several mechanisms has come to a point where, particularly when it comes to buybacks of shares, mm-hmm. and bonus schemes for management, that is really stretching the social contract or cohesion feeling in society. Not so much perhaps in this country, but even in this country, the biggest oil company, Equinor, one year invested much more in buying back shares than in renewable energy. Mm-hmm. It's a paradox. And it isn't to be a joint stock company is to have a privilege of limited liability. So it isn't at all far-fetched from a social contract view or even a liberal balanced view of setting the framework straight, to have conditions. We already have conditions for companies that if you have limited liability, there are regulations about how boards are set up, how the broad governance, and also things about auditing and accounting standards and so forth. But I would like to question, actually, if it should be, and this is a radical thought, mm-hmm. I haven't thought it all the way through, but I think there is an argument for perhaps not allowing companies to buy back their own shares at all, and perhaps not at all being allowed to have bonus schemes attached to something like the share price, because this is creating really this, and we have seen through the last 10 years, a surprisingly low level of investment in the real economy. Mm-hmm. It may be changing now because of things that have to do with the green transition and so on, but there are paradoxes there. We need to channel capital into productive investment, and the rules of the games certainly influences that. Yeah. And in a low interest environment that we have today, capital incomes and prices drives too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And that's something that you see throughout the economy, right? It's not just in the commercial realm that you see those things happening. I mean, the housing crisis that we face in the rich world and was largely responsible for the financial crisis earlier, or in 2008, 2007, and 2008, was a housing bubble that popped, and it's happened several times. If you look at the history of financial collapses, then housing tends to be at least a part, if not the main driver. We were talking before about income security and how that is an essential part of being able to get onto the housing ladder. Without it, of course, there's no possibility of borrowing the kind of capital you need to subsidize that massive purchase. But housing is about more besides, isn't it? It's about building enough of it. And their governments have lagged behind consistently. That is partly through faults with planning, but I think there are technical things that are problematic, and I think we'll move on to talk about taxation later on. But a big problem, as far as I can see, if I look at different countries, is that local taxis, taxes are levied locally, but then they go into a central pot. So there's no incentive on the local authority level quite often to permit development and to maximise the efficiency of development. With that simple change, you would have much more of an incentive at the local authority to level. Sorry, the local authority level to maximise the use of available land and to think about new living concepts, you know, with shared facilities, for example. And in our next episode, we'll talk a bit much more about, you know, the possibility of sharing and the sharing economy as we talk about climate change and the environment, that kind of thing. But on the housing question, you know, that's an essential change, I think. I think one other thing that we might consider is incentivizing development for rental, because ownership is out of reach for most people. And in the absence of some kind of support from parents or maybe a state handout to help subsidize a, you know, deposit on a first purchase, which of course would just lead to further inflation of house prices because more housing would be more available to more people, and it would be counterproductive eventually. In the absence of those things happening, then you need to make renting much more affordable, and I would argue economically equivalent to ownership, not only in terms of the overall cost, but also from a tax point of view. And as I say, we'll talk about tax later on, but at the moment in most countries there is a tax incentive to ownership which does not apply if you're a renter.
On the other hand, I may diverge a little bit on this because I, being a Norwegian and being aware of how strong this sense of ownership, and we are basically an ownership, self-ownership, decentralized ownership kind of democracy. And that is really some, there are some upsides there that are very important as well. And this, if you look at that same issue from the point of building capital for individual families and people, is of course a fact that it's very different in Norway, for example, compared to Sweden, that so many people who come, immigrants coming to Norway, who are so much easier integrated in some ways, and one of the ways that it's easier to own their own homes and get into the housing market and have some benefits of this, and it has also an integrating effect. So you might say, or you might discuss, you can go several ways in order to make it more easier for particularly young people. That is the problem now, I think, to mm-hmm. some extent. And those who of moderate and lower earning capacities to get into the housing market because the house price has been so rising so much. But that's mm-hmm. particularly the case in Oslo region.
Yeah.
It's not a big problem at all around this country, all in all. So we have, in many ways, a very well-functioning housing market and a very liberalized one mm-hmm. that many Swedes are really envying us this mm-hmm. because an advantage of this is also we have a lot of, it's easier to move from one place to another. The flexibility of that when you are an owner, I can take capital with you to settle a new place and so on. And you don't have the queues of when you have rent control, as in Sweden, still.
Yeah.
There is a queue in order to get into the market.
Right.
And it's not decided by market forces. It's decided by official bureaucrats.
Yeah.
So there are problems of going in different directions, but my preference, I think, would be to try to fix the self-ownership idea rather than putting all into a rental market setting. But there can be balancing points.
Sure,
there.
Yeah. I mean, I think a balance is a good one. I'm just saying that I think it would be good.
The balance
if these,
may
be
not right.
Yeah, yeah. And make them economically equivalent. And actually, in most places, if you look at the overall cost of ownership compared to the overall cost of renting over a lifetime, there isn't that much difference between them. Because as an owner, of course, you have overheads and repair costs and maintenance and so on that you don't have as a renter. So different in different markets, but yeah, a lot of the analysis I've seen makes those two activities more or less economically equivalent. But it was interesting what you were saying before about the Norwegian situation and looking at migrants and how within a generation or two, you see a capital accumulation there that you don't see anywhere else. And that implies that, you know, entrepreneurship is going pretty well in those communities, and you know, as generally, you know, what's your perspective
as well,
what's your perspective on the Norwegian scene? I think I've seen quite a lot of analysis that says that entrepreneurship, so innovation within companies in Norway, is very healthy.
Yeah, well, it's true, and you mentioned immigrants. Of course, it's a fact that actually historically many immigrants have been entering the labor market through entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very important channel also from that perspective. But the big thing is, of course, and you mentioned already recent studies by the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor who measure the amount of entrepreneurial activity in different countries in the world, both in inside companies, employee entrepreneurial activity. They are engaged with creating new things and setting up new business units and so on. And of course, the classic startup mm-hmm. and presumably scale up later on of new companies. This, by the way, is the entrepreneurship and the setting up of new companies
mm-hmm.
is the major source of new private sector jobs in the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Has for a long time been. But the critical thing is Norway has had its ups and downs in entrepreneurial activity. We often compare ourselves to Sweden, which I think is a good idea sometimes because we can see how policies and things are working out differently. But there is one thing that we our problem is that we have too few really high potential startups.
Mm-hmm.
We are an enterprising country, many small companies, many people like to start their own companies in this, we're an individualist country and it's this way and it's yep. decentralized all around the country. But we lack some of these strong incentives to attract both capital and talents to join these more high potential. And I think that those are the things that I've been studying quite a lot. And they need policies
mm-hmm.
to strengthen those. But they also can be helped by reducing the incentives of channeling capital into too much housing or secondary homes or financial instruments.
Mm-hmm.
If you will.
Yeah.
So yeah. We are back to some of the same kind of mechanism here that are really crucial. So that would be a help too. This is viewed by most people perhaps as some kind of elite project that you know, make the conditions, the framework conditions better for very ambitious entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
But the consequences, I think, are very much different. They have a much stronger social consequence.
Mm-hmm.
An inclusive social consequence for work and productivity growth. And went back to the Richard Baldwin dilemma.
Yeah.
Right? You remember the competition between job destruction and job creation.
Yeah.
If we don't keep up this machine creating new jobs all the time, we will have big problems. So this is how I see, in a way, the social contract,
mm-hmm.
most people would, in their own best long-run interest, should support policies that makes it easier to create new businesses.
Yeah.
Because that is part of the solution to the Baldwin problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
And underpinning the value of flexicurity.
Sure, yeah. But also,
so that's my basic take on it.
Perhaps mechanisms like one thing that's worked particularly well in the UK is research and development tax credits. So whatever you invest in research and development is not subject. It's not levied or that is rebated by the revenue. And of course, that acts as a boost, an income boost, for as long as you're investing and you're in a position of negative equity as a new company, and indeed as an established one. It's, you know, it's not limited to new companies. Perhaps we can look a little bit at taxation as a kind of preamble to some final thoughts on sort of the fiscal sustainability of the welfare state, because that is a big issue with aging population and increasing instances of chronic illness and that kind of thing as you get in an aging population. If I look at a sort of overall survey of taxation, my impression is that what we see, or what we have seen in recent decades, is a shift away from progressive taxes like income taxes and more towards payroll and social security taxes, which aren't progressive. Another thing I see is a disparity between income and capital, taxes on capital. So that means that for those who can, there is an incentive to disguise income as capital wherever they can. And you see that as a limited company owner in the UK, for example, it's much more tax efficient to take a very, very small payroll income and then to take the rest in dividends. Of course, you can distribute those incomes, those dividends among family members or kind of fake shareholders, and everything becomes very, very, very tax efficient, and it's all completely legal. But you know, there are loopholes there that people exploit. Generally, I think we really need to be very rational about the recycling of capital. Effectively, that's what it is. So taxing rents, inheritance. Maybe not so much the Biden approach, which is to have this fairly high minimum threshold for corporation taxes and to think much more about taxing dividends. Maybe above a normal notional rate, if you took kind of the bond rate, bond interest rate as your notional rate, and you only taxed above that, then you wouldn't run the risk of disincentivizing investment, which is obviously a problem if you go too hard on taxes. I think a final thing, and this is something that we definitely will touch on in our next episode, is to link taxation much more to externalities, negative externalities and social costs. And you know, we're thinking mainly there in terms of carbon taxes, aren't we, in this climate change era. So those are, off the top of my head, some of the major fundamental tax changes I would make with a view to shoring up the sustainability of the welfare state. There are other mechanisms, of course. You know, there are ways in which you can rationalize the welfare state. We were talking about universal income earlier on, and that would lead to a rationalization of the administration of and the payment of certain benefits. But overall, there is going to be a hole, you know, there already is a growing hole in revenue, that needs to be filled if we're going to continue being able to provide all of the, you know, the benefits and the expectations that have become such an important part of the social contract in Norway and many other countries besides.
Of course, when you speak about the tax system, it's one of those big pulse areas that impacts the social contract, we must say. I am trying to synthesize most of what you said initially before you mentioned some policy proposal, is of course that the tax structure is becoming more aggressive over time. So the social incidence of the total tax system has a tendency to work against or create some more inequality. In itself. So, and if I add, you mentioned, of course, you didn't mention it specifically, but of course, when we look into the future and you taxing externalities, of course, carbon emission tax and so on, and of course, we shouldn't forget also that in ordinary people's lives, the local taxes that are not really taxes as such, but you pay for water, sewage, and things like that, with a very huge need for upgrading, that creates higher costs on a per capita basis is also working in a regressive. Both of these factors are working also in a regressive direction, in the opposite direction of progressive taxation.
Yeah.
So, and then we have the income or the wealth part of it. And I think you're touching very important points, very important points. And so one of the things of catering to this property-owning democracy ideas is also to perhaps we should aim for some kind of more progressive inheritance tax, I would say, and actually, on the other side, give everyone a minimum inheritance. For example, at the age of 25, it has been a proposal from before I mention it now, but it would be an interesting idea to, well, most people inherit when they are quite old.
Mm-hmm.
When you need inheritance in order to start your life and so on, it's an earlier phase of your life. And I think it could be a sustainable concept, actually, to, if everyone at the age of 25 is given a minimum inheritance of, let's say, 250,000 Norwegian kroners,
mm-hmm.
a young couple could have $500,000 as start capital into the housing market, for example, or starting a business or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
An intriguing idea. Indeed, Sam Britton of the Financial Times used to put forward this idea as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's intriguing, worth pursuing maybe.
Yeah, absolutely.
But of course, there are trade-offs and there are different ways of doing things. we have to look into it. The sustainability of the welfare state, of course. We are in Norway, you know, we are in this luxurious situation that 20% of the government expenditure are not paid by taxpayers' incomes, but by yield of the
oil
sovereign
fund.
Wealth fund.
Yeah.
So it's extraordinary kind of factor, and it has its dangers and its potential pitfalls. And if we are too reliant on that, and of course that's one of the things we have to look at in the future. But then again, we the sustainability of the welfare state in official documents, I think, it features these threats to the sustainability of the welfare state, typically in terms of the aging society, skyrocketing health care and elderly care costs, medical costs and so on, as a consequence, and less people to take care of those who are working. The proportion of the people in the working population is decreasing in proportion to the ones who are living on pensions and so on. And then you have the workforce participation rate,
mm-hmm.
which is, of course, a very crucial one, that the contribution into the welfare state by working population is very important to keep up. And we have something there that we should be aware of, but anyway, what is the big question mark in this kind of forecast that I made every 4 years or so is, of course, productivity growth
mm-hmm.
in the economy as such makes a huge impact. And it's difficult to know how that is going, but the imperative should be clear that there's many, many good reasons to construct policies that are enhancing productivity growth, also in the private sector. And that is a lot to do with the rules of the game. I know, taxes and a lot of things, and how entrepreneurship is crucial mm-hmm. in order to speed up a creative destruction in a positive way that creates more jobs than it destroys, and so on.
Yeah.
So there we are. The sustainability. We don't have too much time, I think, to go very much more into that in this conversation, but I think we discuss that later on as well.
Yeah.
So we are, I think, come to a point where we have to sum up a little bit and round off this conversation.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And what should we say? Well, we have covered quite a lot of ground, actually, from starting with beverage inspiration here. But of course, as I think that almost all listeners will notice, there is one big challenge that we have been missing during this conversation, and that is the biggest of them all. And that is climate change and the green transition. But that is such an important topic that we will have an own episode for that. The next episode will be all about that, actually.
I mean, in many ways, it is the lens through which we must see everything else, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Climate change and the issue of biological diversity.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Guy, I think we have to say thank you so much for this conversation, a very productive one, and comes up with a lot of ideas that we can work on. So I'm already looking forward to the final and third episode of this series, Conversation about the Social Contract, and I'm sure that will add more important elements of a suggestion for a new social contract from a liberal perspective. So now I will switch to Norwegian at the end. So
very bra.
Thank you. Før vi avslutter, så vil jeg minne om muligheten for å hjelpe oss gjennom å legge en kommentar på iTunes podcast og gi oss gjerne stjerner, så mange stjerner som du ønsker at vi synes vi fortjener. Det vil faktisk gjøre at vi når flere lyttere, og hvis du ikke allerede abonnerer på podcasten Liberal Halvtime, kan du gjøre dette gjennom å klikke på abonner på den plattformen du benytter for å høre på podcaster. Hvis du vil holde deg oppdatert på hva som skjer i Civita, så anbefaler jeg deg å melde deg på Civitas nyhetsbrev, og det finner du på civita.no. Men har du innspill eller kommentarer til denne podcasten og tema vi har diskutert i dag, så send meg gjerne en e-post til larspeder@civita.no. Det er altså larspeder i et ord, @civita.no. Takk for at du hørte på, og på gjenhør.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita. Moderne media.